Okay, welcome to this session, everybody. This is the culmination of 9 months of work, I think, by the Institute, a whole bunch of volunteers, and two presenters in particular today, Bev and Dan and Matthew Crane. But I should put a word in for Vanessa Beenders there from the Institute Secretariat, who's done a massive amount of work to bring this to fruition as well. It's a very topical issue. How does private health insurance survive and thrive? We've seen APRA come out today with a letter to all health insurers asking that very question in the light of the forces that the Institute's Green Paper highlights. We saw the Labor Party come out with a solution to one of the specific call-outs that we had identified in this paper as early as October last year, which is if you have cancer, you have a very high chance of having crippling out-of-pocket costs. So politically relevant. And then in the Herald, in the Fairfax Press over the weekend, a long article, please explain, explaining how the whole surgeons and medical specialist fees work and how that impacts on consumers, and from my reading, a pretty responsibly and authoritatively well-written article. So here we are right in the middle of something which is broadly an issue, and the Institute Green Paper is helping give the profession a voice. Before I go too far introducing the guys, can I please ask that you fill out the feedback at the end of the session, and as usual we'll have a warning bell 5 minutes before the end of the session. Okay, so our two presenters today, Bev and Dan, partner in EY, 15 years experience in insurance and significant naval experience before that, focused on health, general and personal injury insurance, and is appointed actuary or chief actuary to several different insurers. Knows what he's talking about. Matthew Crane, I suppose, also knows what he's talking about. He's a senior manager in EY's government advisory team, focusing on health and human service factors, and based in Canberra, aren't you, Matt? So gaining a different range of clients that you can get by being based in Canberra, but still operates with a wide range of health insurers as well. He was previously the lead actuary for FIAC, so again, another reason for knowing what he talks about. But in my mind, Matthew's biggest claim to fame is that he's the only person I know personally who's done a sub-48-minute city to surf run. Can I pass over to Bevan and Matthew?
Thanks, Stuart. I hope I can do Stuart's introduction sufficient credit. So really, the structure of today's talk is just to run you briefly through the paper, because the paper, I guess, we cover a lot of things in a lot of detail. So the story is really, why did the Institute think the paper was warranted? When we went through the consultation process, what were the key things and key themes that we identified? And then, given it's a green paper, what were the suggested solutions and ideas around trying to rectify some of those? The timing, I guess, in the end couldn't have been much better. It's now after the election. Last week there was lots of out-of-pocket and high medical cost coverage in the media around Dr. Teo and the types of surgery he takes. The first line on this slide, which was written before today, talks to APRA's release today. So I guess there's lots of things that are moving in the same line at the moment, and lots of people having the same kinds of conversations, and I think the actuaries would like to be leading some of that conversation. We think we understand health insurance and we can help the broader community get something better out of it. So that's really the objective. Other elements around the background, obviously high out-of-pockets and premium affordability, and those two kind of work. The consumer hears or actually feels the high out-of-pockets and then wonders what they actually are paying for, and the premiums keep going up, and obviously that's a disconnect with their understanding about what they're buying and their future expected access to services and access to insurance services and really the reality. So the real purpose is around providing a current state, an unbiased current state of the industry, and really that's the other part of where the actuaries felt they could play is an unbiased view. If we look around the last 2 years of media, it tends to not always be an unbiased perspective, or it's just really only telling one side of the story. So then we draw out what we see as the current PHI issues and then propose some solutions. With the consultation, that went for about 2 months in consulting with different stakeholders across the industry. So there were private health insurers, the industry associations relevant to the private health insurers, health consumers, Department of Health is also part of that, private hospitals, practicing doctors. We did approach medical associations. They declined to participate, so that was, I guess, we would have preferred if they did, but that didn't happen. And then we went through about a four-month process with the Institute of Actuaries after we'd written a draft report, and then with the assistance of the Health Practice Committee and in particular steering group, and also selected esteemed actuaries in a process of ensuring that it had the view of the Actuaries Institute. So a little bit more on the background and the context. So when you read the media, you may not realise, depending on how it's measured, but Australia ranks number two in the world for a health system more broadly. And that's a pretty good outcome. And health, the private health space and the public health space really work together to achieve that. So we look at it as a hybrid, and each brings something to the party. So for private health insurance, what we've got is voluntary and community rated, which is quite unique. The issue with community rating is everyone's supposed to be supporting it, but really, how do you get that in a voluntary environment where people who aren't claiming then are questioning the value they're getting? And that's really one of the key challenges we've got ahead of us. The value proposition that is being offered, I guess, is around the shorter waiting times, the choices we have available, access to services that the public system may not necessarily provide, or in fact may not want to provide. And I guess the Charlie TO article from last week is a little bit of a case in point. There was an article about the cost of his services fine, and where that went to is hospitals and to the medical practitioners. Really, it was the next day when one of his patients actually said, and I'm one of those people, and I was more than happy to pay for those services because it meant I'm still alive. The option there was the public system said they weren't going to treat it. There were three private practitioners who also declined to treat. So it was really, there was still someone who was willing to treat. He had a fee, and that's really the nature of it. Where health insurance might come in, though, is really if that person wasn't, it appears, not insured, but if they were, then the hospital side of that would have been completely covered. Now, the medical piece may not have been, and it sounds like there was actually some discussion between the patient and the specialist before they made decisions, but quite commonly, when you're sitting in the GP's chair making a decision about some surgery or some specialist services you need, the price of those services and the general outcomes of different surgeons isn't actually available, and that's really one of the challenges that we've seen. It's a fairly well-known challenge, but it's not known by the consumers and policyholders out in Australia, and that's obviously a big challenge for the health insurance industry, is to make that message get out there as well. So linked, I guess, following on from that is around the perception of poor value for money. The high out-of-pockets, people are buying insurance expecting when they claim that that's going to be covered. They discover after the fact that it's not. But in fact, that mainly relates to hospital services, as it were. And it really relates to the medical part of that. And that's part of the piece of it's not all in the control of the health insurers. And that was one of the pieces we were wanting to bring out, is what's in control of the health insurance space, what's in control of the government space. There's three real participants in that process. It's the medical practitioners, it's the hospitals, and it's the insurers. And really, if one of them goes missing, then the whole system doesn't really work. it really requires all three to work. And so I guess the key thing there is that they should all be starting to work together to make that work better. And I've mentioned around the patients, by the time a patient gets to see the medical provider, the specialist, there's usually been a 1 to 2 month wait, and they're really not going to have a choice about what the price was and the ability to make an alternate selection. And so Matt will talk about some of the solutions around that, but one, of course, is if you can make a better decision on day one. And the third key issue is around affordability. And I guess most people in this room are actuaries, understand what goes into insurance. There's a price inflation component, there's a volume inflation component, and the issue is at the moment premiums are rising faster than normal inflation. In fact, obviously, they're rising faster than medical inflation as well. And it's driven by the medical inflation piece that's attached to health insurance. It's also driven by the volume piece, which is not only ageing, but also additional services that people in their 70s and 80s, historically, surgeons wouldn't have been willing to operate on, and they're operating on people in their 70s and 80s. So the volume of older people is actually multiples of what it used to be on a comparative basis. And that all goes into the mix of paying for a community-rated system. We also see that there's issues around inefficiencies in the supply side. So services without the clinical evidence, prosthesis items, so particularly prosthesis, there's three sets of pricing. One is private, one is public, and one is overseas or non-Australian pricing, and there's distinct inefficiencies between those at the moment, with private health insurers almost mandated to pay the highest level. Now, there might be an argument about that's a subsidy to the public system, but ultimately it's the policyholders of health insurance that are actually subsidising that. So the question is that really fair for those policyholders, or can it be done a bit differently? If we also look at the major, I guess, other issues that we've identified around what can insurers do and what's not really helping, the risk equalisation system that currently exists, it doesn't really incentivise insurers to invest in systems that save money. So when an insurer saves, let's say, 50 cents of a hospital claim, then some of that actually, within that same quarter that's paid, some of that is actually spread across other insurers. And so there's not a strong incentive at the moment for insurers to actually be investing heavily in be identifying where they can create claim savings. And that's an ongoing challenge as well. So and then the final key areas around the perception of private health insurance. So is the value being sold clearly? That doesn't appear to be the case. And the complexity of private health insurance, how it complements the free public system. One of the key issues is around the product design and people being confident, have they got the coverage that they thought they were buying? That's not always the case. The new gold, silver, bronze classifications are about trying to provide some confidence to consumers that when they buy a certain level of product, they're actually going to get a certain level of coverage. And so the idea is that provides some confidence and it should reduce complaints about what they are covered for. What it doesn't do, though, is really tackle the out-of-pocket and the gaps piece just yet. And I think the final piece, with the comparison against an improving public health system, if that is improving, then private health insurance must also improve to make sure it's keeping up. So how does someone get peace of mind that when they're buying products, they're actually going to be covered from an insurance perspective? And the other interesting perception would be around with home and motor insurance. You're really buying that with the hope that you're not going to be making a claim. But with health insurance, there's an expectation that you're almost going to be looking forward to making a claim with your health insurance. And so is that something that also needs to be examined and thought through? Certainly, insurers advertise that, come and join with us and you can claim. And that's their preference because that's their way of showing that they're providing value for the coverage you're purchasing. But ultimately, purchasing hospital insurance is really more akin to an insurance where you hope you don't need to claim, but ultimately you may. So I'll let Matt walk through the ideas out of the Green Paper.
Okay. Thank you, Bevan. Having been through and identified a number of issues with health insurance and the way it fits into the health sector at the moment, I guess the challenge was to think of what can we do about that. Quite clearly from what Bevan's been through, now is the time to act, so the title of this summit is very appropriate for this particular presentation. And so we've been through and thought of a few ideas, and obviously we've had a lot of input from various people we've talked to in forming these ideas. I don't think any of these ideas would be hugely controversial or a big surprise, but hopefully they'll lead to some discussion around a way forward. I guess as I go through these, they're probably in order of importance. Certainly the first one, which is about achieving a level of transparency to patients making the decision around what they're going to actually be treated for, is very topical. We've seen it in a number of articles recently. And really this is about actually giving patients with private health insurance the choice, which is one of the, you know, going back to one of the first slides, one of the key sort of selling points of health insurance, so that's an informed choice. So I guess, yeah, the question is how do we get them to have that choice? And clearly having it 2 months down the track when you're sitting in front of the surgeon who's proposing to perform the procedure is probably not the best way to get the choice. So what we're looking at is getting information out there so that patients, the first time they go and see the GP and they're thinking about a referral, have access to that information. So that would talk about the different levels of costs for the treatments, how much it would cost them, as well as the insurer, and what the associated outcomes of the different surgeons that they might consider going to would be. And obviously, you know, there's a number of complexities with all of this, de-identifying information and obviously taking into account the different levels of risk that different surgeons would attract would all need to be taken into account. But the nub of the idea is to get the information out there to the patient. Obviously, data on its own for a patient in need of potentially life-saving treatment may not be enough, so this is where this idea of a care coordinator came from. And that would be someone with a knowledge of the system, a knowledge of the patient and their needs, who could help them, armed with that information, to choose the procedure that's best for them. And so we've termed that person a care coordinator in this paper, and really that would be a new role. There's not really anyone that does that with access to that information. At the moment, the GP probably does perform that role by proxy, but you know that depends on the information they've got, the connections they've made in whatever location they work. And so there'd be some additional money required to form that role, but the idea would be that overall that would result in lower costs as people potentially choose more efficient and lower cost surgery for the same outcome. And then also there are financial consent rules around having health treatment, and these are aligned to other financial services, financial consent rules, and obviously the situation for a patient in need is a little bit different, and so we think that's just worth having a look at just to make sure that really does meet the needs of a patient in need of urgent treatment. Obviously all of that won't be easy, and you know clearly there's getting the surgeons themselves to participate in publishing that information would be the biggest challenge. And potentially, although it might narrow the range of different fees, there's no guarantee it would actually lead to lower costs. But nevertheless, you know, it seems apparent that that there's a transparency issue here, and you know, competition's probably not working quite as it should, particularly when people are surprised by the level of out-of-pocket costs once they actually find out. So the second opportunity is obviously the most actuarial of all of the ideas out there, and I won't try to cover off all the nuts and bolts in the next few minutes of prospective risk equalisation, but essentially it's not a new idea. This has been around for many years, and as Bevan mentioned, the issue with the current system is that if you make a saving through, you know, improving claims efficiencies without reducing cover, then that saving gets spread around all of the other insurers. So the idea here would be that the way the risk equalisation works is based off an expected risk profile. And then that way, when you write a policy, the expected claims amount from that policy would be would enter into the pool, and then having written it, if you actually happen to be able to drive some savings, then you would get to pocket them, at least in the short term. In the past, there's been issues with that idea because potentially it would mean that insurers would be incentivised to offer a lower level of cover, or as low as they can get away with, in order to drive down those expected costs. But the introduction of gold, silver, bronze, which happened on the 1st of April this year, naturally introduces some flaws at different levels. And so we think that now that those classifications are in place, it might be time to just have another look at this idea, just to see if that can get off the ground. Obviously, you know, changing the risk equalisation regime would result in different winners and losers out there, and so, you know, it would require some level of transition, which would need to be managed carefully, and, you know, the industry would need to sort of think at an industry level rather than individual insurers for this to be successful. But nevertheless, we think it's an idea worthy of pursuing. The remaining ideas, obviously, still very relevant. I guess those were probably the two headline ones. The next one is really about just trying to directly target the costs of claims and trying to just reduce for a given service the cost of that service, if possible. So I guess one aspect of the public system benefits from is that it's all under one roof. There's a budget for a hospital and all of the different procedures that go on there. In the private sector, there's surgeons, there's the doctors, there's the anaesthetists, there's the hospital itself, there's the prosthesis manufacturers, and they all set their own different fees for the different parts of the process, and at the end of the day, the out-of-pockets and insurers end up paying for that bill. And I guess we're not necessarily saying that anyone's trying to go deliberately high in that process, but there's never really a view of what the overall cost of the procedure is going to be. And so potentially, even if it's not forced, that they could be combined in some way, and there could be a thinking around what the total budget for a particular health pathway might be. There are a few areas of cost. As Bevan mentioned, prosthesis items are still very high, and the government has started to look at that, and there have been some savings driven in the last year or two. But they are still very high, and we think, you know, more could be done, and potentially an independent organisation could be set up to actually look at the cost of those and to help drive them down. There's still a lot of administration and hidden fees that occur with different specialists, and again, the government has been looking at those, but we think it's worth continuing the focus and shining a light on where they occur, and in combination with the different statistics on fees and outcomes, that might help compete away some of those fees. And obviously, where bad practice is going on, that should be made very visible. And again, insurers are really looking at the different services they pay for and trying to negotiate with hospitals around the ones that are the most effective. But again, I think that more of a push could be made to link the funding to really those procedures that really work, and you know, making sure that the health outcome is what the patient needs. Again, all of this is going to require a level of collaboration from the different players in the private sector, and that's going to be the main challenge. You know, particularly where you're driving down the cost of prosthesis items, that's obviously going to be difficult to get the manufacturers across the line. The next slide is, well, this is probably the most obvious one in a way. If you take a step back from everything, if we're trying to reduce the cost of the product. If everyone was healthier that had the product, then the average claims cost would be lower. So, you know, it's worth keeping this idea on the table. And, you know, if we can improve everybody's health, then clearly those that have health insurance would also be healthier. So for this idea to be the most effective, broader push to improve the health of the nation. And so, yeah, the government's obviously got a key role to play there. Then, as a kind of slightly separate idea, how do we encourage more health of the healthy people to take out health insurance? And with community rating, that would obviously drive down the average cost of the product. And so, again, this is around the messaging and around trying to think of different ways to encourage young people to take out the product. So thinking of providing additional benefits potentially. Obviously, that would come with a cost if you're going to add something extra onto the product. But if you can encourage enough people to take that out, then that would drive down the average cost for everybody. And, you know, this is no surprise to any insurer, but you certainly think that more can be done, particularly in this digital age, to think about some of the potentially adding on health platforms and things like that that young people would really value. And we certainly see in the extra side of things that people do actually appreciate having something that they can use on a product, even if the cost of that is higher than the benefit that they get. And then, obviously, just to make sure we cover all the bases, there are a number of sticks and carrots currently in place to make sure a voluntary community-rated system works. And they've been around for some time, and it's, you know, it's always worth keeping an eye on whether some of those formula need to be updated. And the final one is just coming back to that point of perception of health insurance. So a lot of the time the cost is what the patient sees, and where it's high or where they have high out-of-pockets cost, the finger of blame kind of lands with the insurer without understanding all of the issues around it. So even if we did everything we've already said, it's unlikely that insurers would come out being everybody's best friend. So we want to think of ways to improve the perception of health insurance as well. And I guess going back to Bevan's earlier point, there is a number of different sub-industries within the private sector. You've got the specialists themselves, the doctors, the hospital facilities, and then the funders, the insurers. And we do often see them pointing the finger at each other for who's to blame. But they really do all need each other. If there were no surgeons, insurers wouldn't have a product to sell. If there was no insurance, not many people would be able to afford to go and see their surgeon. So we just think it is worth sometimes more taking a step back and seeing that they really do need each other, and perhaps forming some kind of collaborative body to get a more consistent messaging around this is the private health sector, this is what we've got to offer, this is why it's a good alternative to the public system in certain situations. And the government's obviously got an important role to play there. We often see the government get involved around the rate change process, and we probably hear less of the advocation of the benefits of health insurance. This is really coming back to that value of having cover, which is often lost, and people don't talk about that. It's very easy to see with your home and your motor insurance, but for some reason with health insurance, and your health is probably one of the main assets you own, we don't hear so much about the value of having cover, even if you didn't actually end up using it. So this is more of a messaging piece, and you know, one of the challenges there will be to get everybody sort of singing from the same song sheet. So that's a summary of all of the ideas we've had. There's obviously a lot more detail in the paper itself. I guess to conclude, there's a lot on the table. Hopefully this will start a conversation or help facilitate that conversation. Insurers do have a key role to play in all of this, but we've seen that they are somewhat limited by regulations which stop them from, you know, operating outside their boundaries. And also the fees that they subsidise are largely out of their control, or to some extent. So it does need more than just insurers. It needs government to take a role. It needs the whole private health sector to come together and really think through, from a patient's point of view, how can we make the private sector work better. So I'll probably just wrap up there. I just want to thank everyone that's helped work on the paper. And there's plenty of people within EY, within the Institute, and volunteers as well on the various committees. It's been a long journey, but it's great to have the paper out there. I think there's some copies at the back that you can pick up on your way out. So yeah, just thank you there, and hopefully there's still plenty of time for some questions.
There is indeed. Well done with the timing, guys. It's a really high-quality paper, available, embargoed until this morning, so this is fantastic timing. And we've got time now for discussions. Can I ask that you either make your point at the standing microphone there, or we do have... I'll get you guys to stand in the limelight here rather than in the shadow.
Okay,
and that can be a roving mic as well. So make your comments through the mic, please. There'll be a five-minute warning before the end of the session, and at that point I'm going to take back from whoever's answering the question at that time and ask you both. So how do members of the Institute use this? Right. So give you notice of that question. Okay, throw it open to discussion from anybody.
Go and stand at the mic, Adam.
I'll just do a quick one. Fully support this. We need more transparency when patients make decisions. Can you each talk about what you think the role of technology is in facilitating that process?
Probably just one person answering each question. But so technology, I guess, if we're looking at how the landscape's changing, people are opening their app and wondering why they can't do their whole life on the app. And that's really where health insurance certainly has got to go. Other types of insurance are headed that way. How much of that can you do on an app? How much of that goes in the digital process? And from where does that start to where does that end? So that really starts in the doctor's rooms, giving them the tools to start with, which was around the care coordination, for example. We see the GP as a likely candidate, you know, at least having starting a conversation in the GP's rooms, give them the tools so that from that process they click a few buttons, the hospital knows about what's coming, the surgeon knows about what's coming, they already have an appointment, it's automatically been done. That whole process should just be fluid, and it's not yet. So I would see that it's a no-brainer about what can be done. It's a matter of, you know, how quickly can it be done. Can one insurer do it ahead of others and get a market lead? Or does it actually need whole industries to work together because it's so disparate at the moment around the provider space, the medical space, the hospital space, and then the insurers? There's some linking going on in the background between hospitals and insurers, but that's really after the fact. None of that's up the front for the customer yet. So I hope that helps.
Adam?
Thank you, Bevan and Matthew, for the paper. Excellent paper. In terms of the theme of time to act, I notice in terms of your recommendations, you have the government as a quite critical player in all of the recommendations, unless I've missed one. And I suppose, in timely given APRA's letter today, so the question is, what can insurers do without relying on government? And so it's to be more pointed, if there's one thing that insurers could do without relying on government, what would that be?
I'll go with the first part of the question to start with. There's certainly plenty of insurers can do, and you know, and none of this would be a surprise to any insurer, I don't think. But in line with what APRA have said today, I think there does need to be a bit more proactiveness around, you know, things are going to change, and if we don't do anything, that dip in participation is going to escalate away. So there really does need to be a think of around what is the value of this product for particularly younger people, and not just making sure that what they're selling has that value to encourage them in, but also trying to message that around. And I guess the industry speaking as a coordinated group is probably it would be very powerful there as well.
Does it make full use of the data to tell the story? Is that part of the answer as well? It could make better use straight away of all the data.
Absolutely. I mean, this recent Charlie. So the question was: are they making the best use of the data that's out there at the moment to tell that story around selling the value? And you know, I think the Charlie TO story this week is probably a case in point there, where you know there's a clear benefit if that person had insurance. That $120,000 that they were talking about would have been probably still a large number, but certainly not making the headlines in quite the same way. So there's a clearly a role for health insurance to play. Plenty of data around, plenty of cases where it's made a real big difference, and the paper has a couple of sort of example case studies as well. So, yeah, absolutely data. And then if the government did make some of these pathways clearer, then data, again, from insurers would be very powerful in helping people choose the pathway that's right for them.
I'll add one line item to that. I think risk equalisation, my recollection might be wrong, but I think it was ultimately insurers in 2004 and 5 and 6 who really didn't all agree, so therefore it didn't get up. So that's one place that insurers could actually help themselves, would be to get back in the room together. They don't need government to do that. Government, obviously, or a regulator or someone needs to be a clearinghouse. That's fine. That's a different issue. The insurers can actually turn up in the same room together and talk about it.
Yeah, it might be there's one thing insurers can do immediately, and that is tell people that have been to hospital how much their hospitalisation costs the insurer. You know, if insurers just told people what the value of their insurance is, it would make a huge difference because people don't know. You go to hospital. I mean, I was incredibly surprised the first time I had an ablation operation. I found out that there was $22,000 worth of instruments that had been put inside me and were apparently still in there, but it turned out they weren't. But that's how much the fund paid. $22,000 for some instruments that went inside me for about 3 hours. Hell. But, you know, that's the thing that insurers need to do. Tell people how much their insurance is really worth, because that gets out. And you can also tell your whole membership, you know, give them case studies, you know. This is so-and-so, you know, don't use names or anything. This, you know, so-and-so, you know, just, you know, Mr. X went to hospital and had this, and this is how much we paid.
Sorry, Gail, for the benefit of the recording, that is Brent Walker, a long-standing health insurance actuary.
Hi, Gail Ganane, and I'm now the Director of a Health Fund. We do all of those things now, Brent. We give examples in our annual report, we put reports out, we give case studies, and we've got members that actually talk about what happened and what the health fund did. So you can do all of those, but I think the really critical thing, I'd absolutely support your position around risk equalisation. It's a lot better than it used to be, but it could be improved further to provide some more incentives. But really the problem is going to be getting government to really tackle issues around prosthetics and also require doctors to publish. Everything else is on a website. Why can't the doctors put their fees on a website and then people can have a look and figure out for themselves what their out-of-pocket's going to be? That would be really scary for the College of Surgeons.
Because they don't charge the same for every patient. Well, that's consumer law for everyone except doctors. Jack Fitzpatrick from HCF. Really enjoyed the presentation and I've read about halfway through the green paper this morning while waiting for the conference. I'm really glad that you mentioned risk equalisation as well, because it, often in these talks about affordability and whether people value their cover, it never really gets brought up that, for, particularly for young people and people on low-end covers, the claim, you look at the cost of risk equalisation and the premium, the claims are often only going to be about 20% of the premium. So I kind of think, why should they value that cover when they're not actually getting that much out of it? Mm. So I was interested in what sort of details you'd had on the changes to risk equalisation you were thinking of.
So there's lots of different models, and in fact Brent has put forward other models, which I acknowledge, but I'll talk to a simplified approach at the moment. So there's a new risk equalisation mechanism that's operating in the New South Wales CDP system that's working. It's driving change in behaviour of the insurers in that market, and the idea is that you've got let's call it high-risk and low-risk participants, and how do you appropriately incentivise insurers not to be avoiding those high-risk and ensuring there's some sustainability in that, and at the same time, what's the fairest way for the rest of the market to be paying for that as well? So a little bit more detail. The major issue that has changed is the gold, silver, bronze basic. Previously, the view was it would have been gamed by the insurers to come down, and that would have been the natural economic outcome. To an extent, that there's now an impediment to that. So the floor is now at each gold, silver, bronze and basic. And also with the strict coding, maybe there's also room for the plus to be part of the pool as well, depending. But essentially, there are additional pools around gold, silver, bronze and basic. It doesn't strictly run from the actual claims cost like the current systems do. There's room to have, I'll call it an actuary in the middle that actually makes judgments because it's a forecast that they're actually going to be paying against. When you write a policy, how much do you get for various sets of risks? Now, we might normally say in health insurance, we say old and young, but in fact, it's high risk and low risk is really what we're talking about. And it may not be old people who've been the high risk. There's also, I guess, mental health is now young people long term. So that's, we're seeing some large claims come from young people in hospital, long stays, several hundred thousand dollars. So that's one element. But the other element to it is to ensure that there is also a high cost claims component, because in insurance terms, that's effectively an excess of loss. So while the pooling system will do an equalisation, you also need coverage for the insurers. Maybe the large insurers less so, but the smaller ones, they need that coverage. And I see that the current high cost claims pool was actually attached to a system that didn't strictly need it, because it's really a surplus type insurance at the moment. But if we go into a future type of risk equalisation, then the high cost claims pool is really essential to just making sure there's a limited risk for insurers. So there's a little bit more colour. There's lots more to talk about as actuaries. There's so much minutiae in that, and it won't be an easy process. But if it's creating the right incentives, is there a way it can now be built? Is probably the key question, and that's really what we've posed in the paper.
The big difference between hospital insurance and the ancillary benefits insurance is the ancillary benefits insurance you claim every year. You claim several times a year because everybody goes to a physio or something, or goes to the dentist. The dentist encourages you to go a couple of times a year. So one of the reasons why the health funds survive is because they've got the ancillary products. With hospital insurance, it's more like house insurance, only far, far worse, because most young people, in fact, right through to about age 50 or even 60, most of your customers probably have never been in hospital, except for the females. So probably would have been in for obstetric reasons, but that's all. So you can go 40, 50 years, well, 30 years paying for insurance without ever going to hospital, which is probably far longer than you'll ever have a house insurance policy without claiming. And that's the problem that we've got. We've got to be able to tell people, hey, listen, your insurance is really valuable. And that's why we need, health funds need to make it clear, like Gail's does. And her fund presumably is growing, because the funds that do this tend to grow. The ones that don't tend to lose members. You've got to promote yourself. You've got to promote the fact that that insurance is really valuable. It's like, it's like insuring your car and your house. You can't go without it.
Yeah, and probably just worth adding that I guess what we're talking about with risk equalisation is not to so much change what it currently does. We think community rating is a good thing, and we want risk equalisation to continue to support that and encourage insurers to want to take on older people and less healthy people. So really the idea around risk equalisation is to make it better at doing that, and then separately almost sell the value of health insurance to younger people. So we're not suggesting risk equalisation change to attract more younger people in. That would be separately to try and promote the value of health insurance.
Anthony Claughton here. Two questions. Just one with the suggestion for improving health generally. Given such a high percentage of costs are actually occur in the last few years of life and everyone will still die, does that actually get you much of a benefit beyond maybe a little time period while that's maybe pushed out a little bit? And the second question is, did you I know it's a very thorny issue and very sacred, but did you look at all at community rating and whether or not that is something which should be changed at all, and whether and what the actual impacts would be of, say, slipping it a little bit so that it was more expensive for older purchases versus younger purchases?
Okay.
Thanks, Anthony. I'll take your second question and then we'll work out if we're going to answer your first one.
So the first one was about whether it's actually beneficial to improve people's health. I guess I guess it is. Like, if you take the money out of things, it's, you know, it's better for the nation if people are healthier. There may not be payoffs for every sector of the population. That's true. But overall, I guess if it's targeted correctly, and, you know, we're taking even, you know, take some data and modelling and sort of investment approach almost to it, then we find pockets where it really is worthwhile and we could target those and there'd be broader benefits, and the health insurance premium would be a second order benefit of that. So we think that's, I guess that's probably what we're thinking in reality is the first few steps of that process. The second question was around tinkering with community rating. So that was something that we did consider, and I'll let Bevan talk more about it. For the reason that there are different views on that, that's probably something that we didn't come out with a firm view in this paper for that very reason, but we certainly considered it carefully. And we took the approach that it's something that's fundamental to the private health sector as it currently is. This paper is around trying to keep it in the balance it currently is as well, so we didn't want to change that, but we did certainly look at it. And community rating doesn't have to necessarily mean that everyone pays the exact same dollar price for the same thing. It can be within means and things like that. So there are areas, and lifetime health cover itself does actually sort of tilt the community rating spectrum anyway. So it's not a pure flat premium as it is. So certainly we think there are things that can be tinkered without taking away community rating. And then
No, that's good. Matt's answered pretty much most of it. Yes, we saw it as something to consider. I guess the scope is really, the context is, this is what the system looks like at the moment, and that's really where we focused the paper. That would be a completely different direction for government and policy to think about. We didn't really go into that. It's a well-known issue with actuaries in the industry. Would it work? Well, ultimately, you've got to work out what would people be willing to pay for around insurance, and then would there's obviously people with higher health risk which would come out at a higher premium, and would they even be in the system anymore, and then what's left in the system, I guess. So it's actually a much bigger question and conversation to be had, and that wasn't really where we were focusing this paper.
Okay, we've had our time warning, so I'm going to go back to that question, how do we use it, but with a little bit of, I didn't warn this particular person. Nicolette, could I get you up here as well, Institute President? We've got an Institute Green Paper, which is high quality, and a lot of work's been invested in it. And can I ask you, first of all, the question to the membership? Come in the floodlight, don't hide in the shadow. What are you looking for from this, both from the Institute membership and for the Institute membership?
Membership?
Or from it. Like, what would you like members to do? We have a community here deeply invested in health.
Yeah, and to me, just actually having heard this discussion this afternoon, this is about thought leadership and about improving the system. And, you know, I've actually got a lot out of listening to some of the questions as well as the paper itself. So, you know, to me, it is a bit of a brave new world. I'm sitting there with a million more questions, actually. I don't know about everybody else in the room, but I could spend another hour here. This is
maybe
about making the system better.
I believe it's going to be taken to parts of government. What would we be looking for from that process?
Is that not a fair question? Well, and can I just say, I've got another hat on. I actually joined a health fund about a year ago on the board, a small one, which actually Bevan happens to be the appointed actuary for. So I've got about as much information as possible to actually be dangerous in this debate. but I think questioning some of these policy settings, and that last question about the community rating, because I think one of the points that you made in the paper was we're one of the few systems with a community rating but not a compulsory system. And at what point does it become unsustainable? To be honest, from my point of view, I've been a bit blown away by coming into this health fund industry and realising this combination of community pricing and a risk equalisation reserve. I've never seen an industry like it. It's like doing business with your hands tied behind your back. There's so few levers for you to pull. So I think it's ripe for actuaries and thought leadership, actually.
Okay. Bevan and Matthew, did you want to say one last thing about how we should use this?
No, yes, sorry, thank you. Quite clearly, I think it's for insurers to see what's in front of them, see what their opportunities are. It's also, I think, as a leader in for government to say, actually, government, these are the places you could stand aside and get out of the way of health insurers, because health insurers actually really, really want to improve the health of their members. They also want to be able to pay the claims and help people get better. And at times, you feel like it's the regulation that's partly preventing that from occurring. So I think the message to government is really, if you can make room and ease up on some of those regulations, health insurers would love to make the system better from their perspective.
Okay, can we please give Bevan and Matthew a big round of applause?